To all of our non-binary friends, to everyone on the spectrum and in between, welcome to another episode of The Shudder Show. My name is Ken Stagnick, and with me, as always, is...
David Marlowe.
David, how are you doing today?
Ken, I'm in a great mood. What can I say, man?
Awesome.
We not only are we discussing one hell of a movie, but we are discussing our first animated film. And, you know, while we both dabble in our enjoyment of anime, we're certainly not what you would call experts, and so we just, and while he doesn't consider himself an expert, but we decided to bring on our own expert. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring you our guest, voiceover artist best known for his work in My Hero Academia, Chainsaw Man, and now very recently Housing Complex C, singer-songwriter and altogether awesome person, Ryan Colt Leaf. Friend.
Oh my gosh, what an intro. Hey, buddy. What? Thank you so much for having me, guys. This is so cool.
Ryan, yeah. it's so wonderful to have you on. Now, Ryan, how could you tell the audience how you and I know each other?
Yeah, I want to say, did the first time we meet, was it at an audition? I'm trying to remember the very first time that we met.
It might have been specifically, like, I think we auditioned together.
I think that's what it was, because I know it was through acting for sure. And was it the commercial that, like, it was some weird commercial or something. Basically we were both like just trying to figure out the acting thing in LA. And we met on the music video.
Was it specifically the music video?
The commercial video. It was on set.
No, I think we ran into each other at one point at an audition.
We might have, you know what it was? I think we had to like go in and like go on camera for that, even though we already knew we were getting it. And I think we met for it. And then we hung out on the day because I was like, oh, I remember this guy. And my bandmates were with me and we like hung out all day on set. That's what it was. Yeah. So we had essentially, to all who are watching, yeah, we ended up becoming friends through just randomly auditioning for something. And it was a commercial for, was it, even though they're not sponsoring you guys, wasn't it Absolute Vodka or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it was some variation of alcohol.
And it was like,
it was either like, it was like Absolute Vodka or like Leinenkugels or something.
Something like that. It was like a ridiculous, like it was like a full 15-hour shoot day, like a huge mansion, hundreds of people. And for whatever reason, me and my bandmates, David, and like two or three other people that we like became kind of like this fun little crew with for the day, they just kept utilizing us in like all these different scenarios. So they kept throwing us around this house all day and like filming us in different things. And we were like playing music and people are partying and it's so funny. And they're like doing our hair and makeup and all this stuff. And it was this giant production. And then, you know, at the end of the day, we're like, well, that was crazy, huh?
we should make a music video. Yeah, and then you guys were so kind to bring me on, and for what is an absolute, like, it was so much fun.
It is the cool video. So then my band shot this music video for one of our songs that was a single, and David so kindly was the star of the video, and co-starring one of the other people who was in the commercial from that day. That's how it was, this amazing, like, beautiful thing of like a bunch of people we knew that we were like, oh, well, because we weren't really pursuing, I wasn't pursuing acting as much then. And we were like, we have all these creative friends, we're making this music video, let's see if we can get actors that we know, you know, that want to do this thing. So gratefully they were down, and it's an incredibly beautiful video. Actually, our friend Derek, who was my bass player, directed it, and it's gorgeous. And David had to wear a space suit, this like really awesome, like this really amazing, like, you know, hilarious, high quality film level space suit.
No, hilariously though, like, obviously that space suit, spacesuit not being made for space, and in fact does the exact opposite and actually kind of brings, like, brought in the sunlight into the suit.
Oh, that's so funny.
So we were out on this
what pier was it?
It was somewhere out in North of Santa Monica.
Somewhere weird, like some like smaller thing that wasn't going to be super populated and something that we could like basically take over for a few hours to shoot. And
yeah, I was in that suit for a few hours thinking, well, I'm out of the sun, I'll be protected. And I get out looking like a fucking lobster. It is. that was fun. But no, like, but all things aside, like we are here to discuss an absolute gem of a film. Now, before we do, Ryan, could you tell us a little bit about your background in animation and kind of where, like why we brought you on? Like what is it that you, that your voiceover work specializes in?
Sure, sure. As I clear my throat. not staged. I mean, it's really interesting because I'm pretty sure the first movie I ever saw as a child was an animated film. I'm pretty sure it was All Dogs Go to Heaven, which if you haven't seen is a phenomenal film. Phenomenal film.
Oh, it is a fever dream of a
Way darker than you'd think. And then Burt Reynolds in an animated movie.
It's incredible. And Dom DeLuise, and like it is primo. If you haven't seen it, everybody watching right now, most people are probably like, what? All Dogs Go to Heaven, the first one. Sorry,
I believe that's the movie where the camera goes through the alligator and comes out his asshole.
Oh my god, you might be right.
Yeah. It's one of those shots that you're like, that's yep. All right, so somebody was having a good time.
That's brilliant. I haven't seen it in a couple of years. I have to go back now and really look for that. That's funny. It's a brilliant movie. But I was one of those people who was raised with the understanding that animation was always a medium beyond something just for children, regardless of there being things for children. I think it's just an amazing medium for storytelling. And as I got older and I became obsessed with the idea of becoming a performer, you know, with acting, with music, all the different things, I remember with wanting to specifically pursue film and theater and all of that. And not really even thinking about voiceover as a logical, possible career route, even though the two things that I did, singing in a band and just loving film and acting in general, like obviously fused very well in that direction to make that. But it took me a long time to like circle in on that. So by the time I got around to realizing that voiceover was something that I really enjoyed doing, I was back into playing video games again because I had taken a long hiatus, and I was back into catching up on a lot of really great animated series and films and all kinds of things that in the last years that I had been in my band and just trying to work and survive in LA, I had missed so much stuff just because I was in survival mode. And suddenly I had this opportunity to kind of like use it as an excuse to call it research, you know, and and soak up.
Yeah, when you were told that your DVD collection could be written off on your taxes.
yeah, that was a good one for me for a while.
It was good while it lasted.
So all of that being said, you know, I've been really fortunate to find a career specifically mostly doing voices for games and anime and animated projects. And what I love is that they are still, if not more than ever, challenging the medium, challenging the concept of what is, you know, appropriate for kids, adults, the whole thing, and really pushing, I think, the art form consistently, even in the face of like giant companies being like, I don't know if animation's that important, you know, like.
Well, did you guys hear what Bob Chopik, the CEO of Disney, said?
What
did he say?
He said that animation essentially is for kids, and that he wants Disney to have live action stuff because when parents go to bed, they want to put on something for themselves. And that to me is just, have you never met a Disney adult? Like those, like they, like, first off, like, I know so many adults who just like, and I mean like four quadrant movies for everybody. And, you know, yeah. like The Incredibles and any of the Pixar stuff, that stuff plays across the board. But then you get something to the movie that we're talking about today, which is a little movie called Perfect Blue, which I'm sorry, like is just a movie that happens to be animated. I'm actually kind of flabbergasted that nobody has directly made this. I mean, Aronofsky kind of remade this with Black Swan.
That's what I was just going to say.
Well, the shot where she's in the tub and she's like, she's got her face down in the tub. Aronofsky took that and used that as the influence for part of Requiem for the Dream.
Yeah.
Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah.
Jennifer Connelly's in the tub.
Well,
it's taken also, directly from Perfect Blue.
This well, film definitely has that surrealist balance too, where you're just like, where am I? What's happening?
Well, there's other movies that he directly borrows from. Like he borrows from Three Colors Blue. There's that image of her face against the red background. And that is like, you pull up the frame from Three Colors Red. It is either one of the most spectacular, I guess two geniuses had the same idea, or one person saw that movie and was like, I'm going to put it in my animated movie in Japan, because what am I going to do? Make the best animated scary movie of all time? And he did.
Well, I think it's like the Bowie philosophy, right? It's, you know, great artists know how to take from what inspires them and like mold it into the next thing. It's this constant, like everyone is just inspiring the next wave of creators. And I love seeing homages to things in my art in general. Like, I mean, I don't know if you guys have seen the opening to Chainsaw Man yet, but just the opening, you know, like intro song and everything visually, it's an homage to like 15 different classic films and all these different references and things in such a sneaky and fun and psychedelic way that like I love those things, because to me it's people going, look, these are the people we're taking inspiration from, these are the flavors that you might if you're interested in these kinds of things, you might get where we're going with this. But it's never like a direct steal that feels like, you know, when I see a movie with a visual reference like what you're talking about, I don't feel like the director is like, I hope nobody notices. I feel like it's almost like the director is going like, this shot is so amazing and the people who know are gonna know. And it's more like, right?
Nerd writing a love letter to a fellow nerd. That's the reason why they're there in the first place.
Yeah, if you recognize a shot from Three Colors, like, yeah, when I saw this, I was like, oh, buddy, look at
us.
Simpaco.
Exactly.
You know, it was like, where, like, what is it, like that, the scary movies, the Not Another Teen movies, all of those references just feel like a, hey, here's the thing. Do you recognize it? Look.
Yes.
Hey, do we not like, or do we like, huh? And that's what well, like it's like what Tarantino gets so well, or the Coen brothers get so well, that they're really like remixing things. That like my favorite thing about going to see a Tarantino movie is I know there's going to be like 10 movies I learn about that I'm going to want to go check out. And that's what I think you want to try and do with your references, is open people up more. And like, this is a perfect example of Aronofsky goes and makes Requiem for a Dream or Black Swan. And if you're going to borrow from an animated horror movie and the best, and transfer the mediums, transfer the genres.
That's so true. Because you also know that inherently, unfortunately, less people are going to be seeing that. Mm-hmm. And maybe even inherently by seeing the live action homage in that moment, it may do what you were talking about also, is, you know, people go look into it and go, that shot was so cool. Oh, wait, that shot was kind of referencing. Oh, what is this? Oh, wow. I'm going to watch that.
Well, yeah, if you liked blank, you're going to love blank. Is what you want to be trying to do. You want to open people up to more worlds of cinema. This inspired me, and look what I can do with it. Because there's so much in this movie that you can see other people kind of borrowing from. Just the vibe of this movie. On top of it, like, there are so few animated films that have such a powerful sense of composition as I've seen in this movie. Like, so many frames are just like drawn in a way where, like, why is there a poster obscuring half of the frame? I do that in photography, but like in animation, why would you? And it's because this person is not trying to make necessarily pretty pictures. They're trying to make the most evocative image to tell the story.
And I might be misspeaking, but I'm pretty sure this was his first movie.
Yeah, and Ken, you and I was literally just about to bring that up too, because Ken, you this month, the films we have covered seem to have a knack for being the filmmaker's first film.
Oh, that's wild.
They simply just knock out of the park.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? it's a home run. What were the other ones that you guys have done so far?
One of them that we did this month was Phantasm. We also did Carrie, which was Stephen King's first direct adaptation to film.
Yeah, and not Brian De Palma's first movie, but definitely the first movie that everybody knows Brian De Palma from. He's got some other early stuff, but that's borderline film school stuff. We did Psycho Gorman, which was not the director's first movie, but I don't know if you haven't seen Psycho Gorman, Ryan.
I've heard of it.
It's incredible. Oh. It is 90 minutes of pure joy. If you want
to
smile
just and laugh ear to ear, it is one of those.
It's one of those that's like that usually gets recommended to me like randomly, and I'm like, oh right, and then I instantly, you know what? I'm gonna write it down right now.
It's what if Power Rangers was for adults.
Well, I actually read something that was saying how, funny enough, it's one of the inspirations for Chainsaw Man. The weird layers of how many things inspire what Chainsaw Man is makes so much sense when you start watching it, because it is the most like random mashup of genres and flavors and emotions. But there's definitely like a tinge of that in there, and that was also why I was like, right, that's why I heard it recently.
That's definitely Psycho Gorman. It is a movie that I didn't know was made perfectly for me. Every single thing in it is just something that I love that I've never seen everybody kind of mash together and make it work.
It sounds like a perfect like midnight movie.
Oh, absolutely. Like this movie, like invite your friends over who like it, because especially with a title like Psycho Gorman, you're like, but like I recommended a bunch on this podcast, and both our viewers and David kept being like, we'll try the other one. And I was like, okay, but it's really fun. And because the title makes it sound like it's just going to be like a really wet splatter fest. And it's honestly really kind of sweet and progressive, and Psycho Gorman PG is like a gay icon, and like amazing. It's so amazing. Yeah.
And no, honestly, I'm sold. I'm so sold.
Ken, I have a My Hunky Boys t-shirt coming in soon. And it's
yes.
You'll understand it when you see it. It's just
I figured it was a reference. I was just gonna say, like, I love when either a friend turns me on to something or I turn a friend on to something, and it just like it becomes, you know, their favorite thing also, or vice versa. And suddenly you're like, oh, I got the shirt, or I got this thing. Like suddenly it's, you know, it's this special shared inside thing. There's nothing better than that.
This man has not seen Lucky McGee's May, and I cannot wait for him to watch it for the first time ever. Man. It's going to be so much fun. But no, but sort of like it's kind of like what we were talking about with just this being the first film in his arsenal, and like he only made four feature films. Unfortunately, I think it was pancreatic cancer, by the way, that he died of.
That's what it was. Ooh. Yeah.
So he made four films. He made Millennium Actress, Tokyo Godfathers, and Paprika, as well as Perfect Blue.
So Paprika, I actually was still living in New York when it came out in theaters, like its initial theatrical run. And I remember being in Tribeca, somewhere in Tribeca, with our friend Derek. And
really?
I don't remember if we had planned on seeing a movie that day or if we just happened to be there. It was like the afternoon and we just had a few hours to kill. And we went by one of these big theaters, and it was, I think we just, I didn't even know what it was. I didn't know who he was as a director. This was the first film I had seen from him. And I think we just saw the poster or something, and we're like, that looks so wild. Let's just go see it. And there was a screening like happening more or less in the next like 15 minutes that we were there. So it was like perfect. And I think it was like me and him and maybe like 15 other people, because it was like a random matinee on like a Tuesday. And we just had our minds absolutely blown. Like, it was such a phenomenal experience visually, everything. And then a few years later, when Inception came out, we were like, huh, Interesting. And again, which
I guess,
we're
I guess
about,
apparently yeah. that was Christopher Nolan has taken a lot of his influence from his films as well. And Paprika is certainly one of them that he bases Inception off of.
Yeah. So, you know, to go back to what Kenneth was saying before, I think it's, you know, you see this a lot where, especially you so aptly put it about how live action directors will usually take from the animated medium to even just see if the shots transfer or try things in that way. I mean, how many times, dude, your shirt, how many films have done the Akira slide, you know, like,
oh yeah, they just didn't know.
I know. Which was amazing. Cause I remember sitting in the theater seeing Nope, and I was next to my buddy, and like, you could tell who was a nerd in the audience because the second it happened, like I hit my buddy and like, you heard other people make a sound, but it was like only enough people that you were like, you know, cause it happened so fast.
Yeah. Oh, and so you're talking about the Akira motorcycle slide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah.
you either instantly see it or it just looks cool. You know, either
yeah,
way.
It's
like,
a great shot either way, but yeah, I mean, they do it in The Matrix. They do it in tons of movies. And if you know it, yeah, you just hear like 15 people in the audience go, ah, ah,
and it never gets old. I don't care. Movies can keep doing it forever and it's never going to not be cool.
Mm-hmm.
No, I am. And it's, what's also crazy is that, I mean, because Satoshi Kon, he started as a manga artist. And I think originally, like, he was in school to be a painter, and then eventually moved into to manga writing. And manga, he thought, like, I eventually would like to actually work in animation, and manga is the perfect place to start. It's pretty much you spend your whole time telling a story in pictures, pretty much. You're just doing, you're storyboarding your story.
You're constantly, I mean, the schedule for being a mangaka is wild, because often it's they're writing and drawing it together. Is. Yeah.
So there's a YouTube channel called Super Eye Patch Wolf, which does some great videos on anime that I can't recommend enough. There's one actually on Perfect Blue that's great, but there's another one where he talks about what makes manga as a storytelling medium so interesting. And it's because, like, unlike even most American comics, the manga is usually done by like one person or maybe two, and it's done unbelievably cheap. And so they can really take a big risk or make an incredibly personal story or just push things in an interesting way. There was a artist that he was talking about, Junji Ito, who does these incredible manga.
He's a horror legend.
And like, looking at the images in his comic book, it's also one of those things where you're like, I bet you that doesn't translate to like live action in a way that you can on the page, especially with like the black and white kind of the pencil sketch style.
The closest thing to like, I feel like the closest thing to like Junji Ito in film format is like David Lynch. And it's hard to like, it's almost like expressionistic in some of his imagery, because it's so, the depth and the strangeness of it. And I think Lynch is the closest person to like capture it in another medium. But you're right, you're so right. I think that's what makes his work so special. It's so unsettling and weird and beautiful. And I know that they're actually making, I forgot if it's a few different projects or specifically one, I think Uzumaki is being made, but Junji Ito, basically they're making it into an anime, so it's going to have an adaptation.
That's, it'll be interesting
in the next year or so.
Yeah, because I know like there's one comic where he does where this town is inundated by these floating heads, and then everyone realizes the floating heads, each one of them has like a head of their own that's floating up there. And then these heads come down and they drop a noose and they hang the person and they just take them up into the air, and they never explain what's happening. And like, the images are so weird and creepy. It would be one of those things that you'd really need an amazing concept artist to translate those images to work so well from the page
to make them feel the way.
To make them feel like they feel on the page. Yeah.
And there's some unbelievably sadistic, like disturbing horror in manga that is just, and it's, it can only be told in that medium. It's just such a, oh God. Like, I even think, like, for example, like Parasite, which is an anime now, like started as a manga. And it's the idea of like, okay, what if this parasite came in was supposed to take over your whole body, but you were able to cut it off, except so it only controls your arm, and it can just form into whatever object it needs to. And I don't know, it's the idea of like going into a room and all of a sudden someone's head just explodes into 1,000 pieces. And then turns out it's like a monster from The Thing and just like engulfs your whole body. It's such a, I'm trying to remember the name of the manga that it was based off of, but it's just so chilling. And it's just like, and I cannot think of a more perfect medium for Satoshi Kon to come from to get something like Perfect Blue, which, let's face it, compared to other animes, does not, like, it has a very...
It's not pull punches.
No. Well, it's not even that it pulls punches, but, like, also, too, like, it's very realistic. Like the animation style. Oh, yeah, style
it holds it, up in it, such a beautiful way still. It's incredible. Yeah,
it almost satirizes or pokes fun at anime as we know it today, which is the ultra big eyes. Like it's like there's points where the main character Mima is coming out of the grocery store and you see a poster of like a manga or an anime in the background, and it is your stereotypical, as we know in the West, to be anime.
Well, I think that in general, thankfully, that perception is changing now. That, you know, I think when anime first started showing up in the West, a lot of people, they like picked out a select few things and we're like, this is what everything is, right?
You know? All anime is Pokemon, and it's all
Sailor Moon. It's like the same thing as, you know, someone watching Dumb and Dumber and be like, that's all of cinema. You know, like it's, you know, anime and manga, there is a genre and a story for everyone. There are comedies, there are incredibly, you know, wholesome slice of life things. There are really dark, horrific things. There are, the studio that's doing Chainsaw Man, MAPPA, they've done quite a few projects, including this one, that like talk about realism and touching on like the artwork, making you feel like you're living in a modern, you know, very gritty kind of grounded place. Like there's so much of that happening. And I think even performances and music and everything, they're treating it so much more cinematically now. Like,
well, I think my favorite anime of all time, I think that it was literally, I think the first anime that I started really seriously getting into when I was kind of like in grade school was Cowboy Bebop.
I knew, yeah, I was like, tell me it's Bebop. Yeah. Well,
Bebop, I think, was the biggest, like, the form of anime that made a lot of the Western world realize.
It created a whole generation of fans.
Oh, this can be, this is much more than what we thought anime was.
I saw Bebop for the first time earlier this year. It was just because it was one of those things where I was always like, yeah, no, it's great. I'll get to it. And then I saw it and I'm like, this is incredible.
You're like, I get it now. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, like it's just like, of course this was great. I don't know what I was expecting, but yeah, it was absolutely incredible. And not what I was expecting, but both more and better. And yeah, this is the same kind of thing where it was just like, just because it was animated, they just decided to make a full on like a movie. They just wanted to make a movie, and this is happened to be the way that they did it. Like the film stock is just animated, because like let's say, like, trigger warning for everybody out there. There's like two rapes in this movie. Are there? Because like the second one might not have happened, but then also the first one. Oh my God! The moment when this woman the actress in this decides to do a rape scene in a movie, and it has one of the most horrifying polite moments when they are just in between takes and the guy leans down and just says, I'm so sorry. And it's that like, hey,
and she goes, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's such an intense scene, but then I've been in movies where, or I've been in films where we, like a lot of horror films where the content has been very, very uncomfortable, and the mood is very confusing because
it is such a
traumatic event that you are portraying, but then all of a sudden you're taken out of that moment where they hold the sound or they hold like, or they need to readjust a light somewhere. Meanwhile, you are literally
emotionally like, and mentally in this other
looking
space,
at this person that, and then like their whole veil comes down and she's like, oh no, it's fine, everything's good. But she is acting her ass off in that scene, and all the while, but then it's really puts across how traumatic that scene can be, not necessarily while they're filming it, certainly during that period as well, but like also afterwards when they're like kind of thinking about, they have no control over the editing, they have no control over like what the scene,
what it's going to look like. Yeah,
what perspective the filmmaker is trying to tell that story from.
I think just the fact that this is an animated movie that has maybe one of the best portrayals of what it is like to be in a live action film set, and like the, like the, like as someone who has filmed multiple sex scenes, they are the least fun, least sexy, least enjoyable part of your job, even if it's like a fun sex scene.
As someone who has been on the set of Westworld during those scenes, I can tell you right now, it is both awkward and just very unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
Because you realize people how on set that conduct themselves.
Yeah.
There are people who conduct themselves on set very professionally and that do what they need to do. But then sometimes there are just some real pieces of shit that think that they are there to have some fun and make some really messed up comments. And that, I mean, Wes being on the set of Westworld was a really interesting look into how not to shoot an orgy. If anybody has ever seen the show Westworld, it's just pretty much, it's a fantasy land about what, like literally like as robots who look as real can look, there to, you know, beckon to your every will. And you know, and that's always part of it. It's if someone makes an android, someone's first question is usually, "Can you fuck it?"
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Ex Machina very much deals with that. But actually, David, very quickly, speaking of what Westworld was about, why don't you tell the people at home what Perfect Blue is about? Being that we're like a half an hour into the podcast right now.
We usually talk about what it's about halfway through. So to explain more what it's about is the character Mima is a pop idol in a singing group of three. And as the movie opens, she is making an announcement to her fans that she is deciding to retire from being a pop idol to pursue acting. And some of her more passionate fans do not take kindly to that and begin sending her threatening faxes, to give you an idea of just kind of what year this movie was set in, which we'll talk about again here in a second.
Mm-hmm.
But then also members of the film that she is working on begin dying or begin getting horribly, horribly murdered. And reality begins to shift. All the meanwhile,
she goes on the internet for the first time and someone is writing a diary in her voice, and it's very specific about what she does, which is correct. But then how she feels is not, because she's not writing this. Like one of the actually also really interesting things about this is like all of the technology in the background is stuff you recognize. Like she logs on with an Apple IIe, but the color one, not the green and black one. And like she has a PlayStation, I think one.
Yes,
on
the
her.
First. Yeah. So yeah. So to give you guys an idea, so that this film debuted in 1997. And to give you all an idea of what 1997 was. Bill Clinton begins.
What was 97?
Yes, 97. Let me bring you through the cliff notes of 97. Bill Clinton has begun his second term as president. Bill Gates returns to run Apple. The notorious B.I.G. is gunned down in a drive-by. Heaven's Gate cultists commit mass suicide. Men in Black is in theaters. The N64 reigns supreme. Google.com is registered, and Titanic breaks box office records. That is what is going on in that time. And man, oh man, I can't even begin to tell you how just on the nose this director nailed what the internet would eventually become.
Yeah.
The whole theme of this movie is projection and the idea of what it means to project your opinion onto somebody else based on the very visual level that you are seeing them. So it's the idea that her stalker and her fan who is super obsessed with her only sees her pop icon image. So when she shifts away from that and becomes an actress and starts to do all this mature work, like filming a rape scene or doing a very scantily clad photo shoot, that does not line up with this projection that this fan has of her. And yeah,
Instagram specifically.
Well, yes, also even just the idea of like this concept of the second you become successful at a craft, people decide that that is your identity and that is everything that you are. And the second, I mean, how many times has I think we've come to comprehend at this point that creative people are creative people. And if they like being part of making something, they're probably inherently interested in other avenues. So when a singer suddenly wants to do a film, or an actor suddenly makes an album, like the first reaction from fans, the first reaction from people who are fans of that person is usually like a weird kind of knee jerk thing. It's not necessarily like, I'm so excited that this person is doing this. It's usually like the masses are going, what? This person is an actor.
It's Jeremy Renner putting out an album and you'd be like, really, Jeremy? I mean, sure.
Jeremy, what are you doing?
Or Eddie Murphy's album, or Bruce Willis. Never has someone been so mad about being a movie star and not like a fun blues guy, but he'll do the movie star thing. But he really wanted to go do music instead, and he seems pretty mad about it.
Or even just the reverse of like, and Ken, I'll name a movie right off the bat, Cats. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. It's a lot of people like Jason Derulo moving over to this. I think a lot of people reacted that's interesting. And then sometimes you have sometimes it works, like Justin Timberlake, I think, was able to make the transition.
That's ultimately what I'm getting at, is like, I'm not necessarily commenting on anybody's skill set. Some people it works, some people it doesn't. But I think it's more interesting that the commentary that the fandom of artists are very uncomfortable inherently with like their version of the thing changing.
Yeah.
You know, like even when an artist, forget about even changing mediums, when a band makes their next record, whatever that inevitably is, or a filmmaker makes their next film and it's not the previous thing, you know.
Yeah, not like, more of the same.
People are like, it's like this like betrayal. And I find that so fascinating, because from a creative place, we know that artists are, they're hungry to evolve and to try new things and to pursue the unknown to them. And it is a fascinating
conversation. And it really leads into some like seriously toxic behavior from many different people. In fact, like one of the things that was going on at this time, and I'm trying to look up the name specifically of, the film itself wasn't based off this event, but this event was going on around the time of production, and he kind of leaned into to what was happening. I'm talking about the murder attempt against Icelandic singer Bjork.
I didn't even know there was a murder attempt on Bjork.
Yes, a hyper-obsessed fan by the name of Ricardo Lopez found her address and attempted to send her a package containing weaponized sulfuric acid and planned to kill himself afterwards so that they could be together in death. He made a full video diary, and it is. I have watched it, actually, and it is chilling.
That sounds disturbing.
Isn't he the one who shoots himself? Yeah.
Yeah, and he was, I mean, like, he was primarily, like, he had a lot of really troubled opinions and thought. A lot of it was mental health issues that he refused to address, and his family wanted him to address, but he kind of, like, he would make them think that he was. But also, too, is the fact that at the time, Bjork was dating this other I can't remember his name, a black celebrity. And the fact that he was black really upsets this man. And so part of like a lot of his video diaries were just very hate filled. And it was, but again, there's that really toxic projection that you see and you see it so much today. And I think this film really kind of gave you a preview of what the future was going to be like on outlets like Facebook and Instagram and TikTok, where you have these personalities on there that put off a certain personality, and then everyone gets upset the second they deviate or behave even remotely human outside of that.
Well, just take any of the Disney pop princesses or princes who came out and then had to pivot, like Miley Cyrus or Ariana Grande, where all of a sudden, like, everyone's like, whoa, hang on. Or Britney Spears, another example where she went for, well, Britney Spears was always fairly sexualized, but something like Miley Cyrus is a great example of, she does Wrecking Ball and everyone's like, what happened? And you're like, well, she's an adult now, or at least like a grown teenager with hormones. I don't know if you know this, but teenagers are pretty horny. So I'm not surprised that this, you know, and a lot of people freak out. I know, like Ariana Grande, when she was coming off of iCarly, right? I think that's Ariana Grande's show. She came off of that, and they were like, oh, do you want to do a bunch of pop stuff? And she goes, no, I kind of want to be like more of an R&B person. And they were like, that doesn't really fit your image. And so she kind of had to go in, just do it anyway. And then everyone was like, oh, actually, we do really like Ariana Grande. Let's let her do what she wants to do, as opposed to just doing what I'm assuming her managers and agents want her to do, which is, again, make more of the same, which is weird because, like, we praise the Beatles for being a band that evolved over time and that every album changes. And it's not just, you know, it's not just Twist and Shout the whole time. Right. You want to see bands try something new or take a swing and a miss. Like I would much rather
God forbid She-Hulk try to, you know, do something a little different.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But I mean, like, but also too, like in Satoshi Kon during production of Perfect Blue, like he decided to start his own website as like a production diary. It wasn't intended to explain him or his personality to other people. And so he didn't expect that many people would read it. And as he quotes, he's like, I had many reactions from these people, which surprised me a great deal. It makes me happy if people are interested in my work, but not when they're interested in me. Mm-hmm. So when I received all these reactions, I didn't know how to keep my distance from them. And that is, if that is not.
Well, I think the concept of, you know, I think it's been talked about a lot more now in the last couple of years because it's become more of a, I think with social media and everything, there's so much immediate connection and interaction to people that you are fans of and all this stuff that the term, you know, parasocial relationship, you know, this film definitely touches on that concept. And I think that in itself is such a deep, deep thing that still needs to be discussed, you know, heavily, because on the other side of it, there are, you know, artists and creative people who will take advantage of that element of fans, you know, being obsessed with a version of this person or whatever that they think it is, and having it actually kind of, you know, be a manipulative tool. On the other hand, it's also, it gives people this license that they feel where they're like, well, I know this person, so I can comment freely about, you know, my opinions about them left, right, and center and all this stuff. And it's this weird thing where, you know, you have to remember that, like, you don't actually know these people.
Well, and what they're putting out there might not be the truth. You take somebody like Dan Bilzerian, who clearly was just like, who's renting his house and putting, you know, and paying girls and putting out this incredible, alpha male thing. And then it turns out, he's kind of broken, bad at business. And a lot of these girls getting paid, and it looks great on the gram, but in reality, none of that is true. It's all crafted image of what you want
persona,
everybody to think. Yes, exactly. You know, it's exactly. I mean,
and
it's
the pedestal, same thing, good or bad, no matter what, good or bad, putting anyone on a pedestal is just so dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think also like we are dealing, like, I think there's a lot to be said about like what's going on with like, say, some of the stuff that's happening with the Snyder Cut, where once you start listening to fans, you like, it's very easy to M. Night Shyamalan yourself and mm-hmm. become so obsessed with the image that everyone tells you that you are of, you know, the master of suspense. And it's always got to be a twist that, hey, M. Night, maybe just go make some movies and not always just making the same thing over and over again. Like, and just the, like, it's such a, like, I remember when they cast Daniel Craig as James Bond and everyone's like, oh, he's too blonde. And I was like, I think he's going to be fine. Or Ben Affleck being cast as Batfleck. And everyone's like, this is going to be the worst part of the movie. And it was like,
Heath Ledger as Joker.
Yeah, Heath Ledger as Joker.
Maybe the biggest, maybe the biggest cultural turnaround in like all of cinema was like the masses being like Heath Ledger to Heath Ledger, like, which is one of the coolest, like, I'm so glad that that happened. It's unfortunate that he was not around to see it, but
it's crazy though, because you kind of we're sort of seeing the reverse of that right now with people like Kanye West, where we really you have his fan base that really just wants to enjoy his work for what it is.
And he won't get out of his own way.
And to really, exactly. And then, but the reality of it is that he's a very mentally ill individual who is really spouting some very difficult
conversation than, you know, it's clearly a much larger issue that has to be dealt with him in general. And I think the harder part is, like, you know, people like that having a platform, it's just a messy experience, you know.
And it's just like the people who kind of want to keep, you know, lifting that person up, but the idea is like their projection of him and like the glory days of Kanye West and what he used to be is like they just want to keep that image in their head. Kind of like the idea of like in this film, like you have Rumi, the character who was at one point who attempted to be a successful pop icon, and now she's a representative, but like she projects what she wishes her life was onto the character of Mammy. And it's obviously unbelievably unhealthy and leads to nothing but like a horrible outcome, but a genuinely just terrible outcome. Which by the way, I'll take
basic understatements for 1,000, David.
Oh yes. No,
that's a good way to sell it without spoiling it.
Yes, exactly.
Though, and now we might get into a little bit of spoilers here because I am genuinely curious. I kind of want to go down the line and I want to get, what do you guys think actually happened?
Oh God, I still don't know.
Do you think like what do you think is the reality of it?
Well, like, I definitely think Rumi the assistant. That's because like once she gets hit by the car,
right?
And they react, and like the person reacts to both of them because like our with our main character, you can't. She's an unreliable narrator.
Right.
You don't know what is.
Yes.
So you can't. Anything that you see that she sees or if it's from her perspective, you have to take with a grain of salt. But once they both get hit by the car and so now we're seeing it from the perspective of the dudes driving the car who are definitely like, there are two people here.
Yeah.
That I think we can say, at least in my opinion, happened. I think the stalker is the projection of her maybe, but they also could just be two sides of the different parasocial coin, the person from the outside looking in and the person from the inside looking at, like, who can see what's actually happening behind the scenes. That I think is, that's what's so good about this movie is like, we could have this discussion for hours, I think.
And but I very much agree with, I think, a lot of what you were just saying. I think that's like, and I also, the optimist in me, you know, what is her last line in the movie when she's like, no, I'm me.
I'm real.
Like, yeah, I'm real. Yeah. Like the optimist in me, you know, wants to be like, all right, we're here now. Like we've come. Yeah, exactly. Like, because I don't think the strength of stories, either way, the beauty of this is it's a subjective opinion. Like, you know, when the first time people see the ending of Inception, they're like, you know, and even if the director has a definitive idea, you can still take with it what you decide is yours. But I think that there's something really beautiful about the idea that like you can travel through an experience such as this and this kind of a depth of darkness of story and come out on the other end and it not be a tragedy. You know, I think there's something empowering at the end of it. I want it to be that, you know, at least.
Yeah. I part of me almost thinks that the stalker, the fan, the super intense fan, I think that he was Rumi.
Yeah.
And I think that that's why he disappeared, is that she attempted it once. And because she had been so like she'd been manipulating Mammy so much mentally, she couldn't really keep track of where she was or the time of day. But because even then, there's a great video on YouTube that talks about the use of the colors red and blue in this film, and the idea that Rumi is represented by the color red, and you'll see constant the two major colors in this film, that when you see Mammy being portrayed as her purest self, you usually see blue in the background. But when Rumi is like front and center, you can tell she's kind of manipulating the situation. You see a background of like heavy reds. Mm-hmm, but at the end, when she gets in her car is that deep red. But then when she looks in the mirror, you have the blue background. So I'm beginning to think that her and Rumi are kind of, or that Rumi and the stalker are kind of the same person.
Well, also I would say that this, because like the scene that I have the most questions about, yeah. I would say, is the pizza murder. And because I think you could make arguments for all three of those characters possibly being the one behind it. And I think it's really interesting that it's the photographer who gets murdered at that point. He is watching a projection TV, and the very background, a projection TV at that time, is a red, a green, and a blue light. So again, even if we're using the red and blue, well, there's one for each of them there, and then there's also a green. So that could be and again, this is an animated movie. This wasn't like, well, we want to use a projector and that's just what it looked like. Like, no, that was a choice. Was a
choice.
They,
yeah.
Yeah.
They drew that choice.
Yeah. You put those colors there. Yeah. And again, like, and that, because like with that murder,
that's a great, yeah.
Yeah. She's good. Cause she finds the bag that's of fantastic. Clothes at oh my home. God. You know, but you don't know if that is a projection of what she saw there. Because even the final fight that she has, if it is with her, well, then the other girl who they portray as a little bit of a bigger girl, like just a middle-aged woman who's a professional and doesn't have to be professionally pretty. She apparently is following her this whole time along the rooftops, which how is that happening? But then again, there's a couple of times they cut to like reflections of her, and she goes from this like floating version of the anime girl, like of the pop idol girl, to all of a sudden like this very sweaty, like running really hard, working really hard, which again is more reasons why this movie just keeps shifting your perspective and making it so we can have this discussion, as opposed to something where it's just clear. Like, this is something that actually that I think he gets here along with David Lynch, which is like it's not about the answers. It's about the discussion that you can have. And like, you're missing the point if you are trying to back into this as a puzzle and being like, there is an answer. Yeah. Like, no, the answer is this discussion we're having right now.
And this is why I asked all of you, because I'm just so curious, because there are so many different points of view for this. And this is what I love about this film, is that it's all interpretational. Like it's a projection. Which is the main, in my opinion, the main theme of this is just like, what are you projecting onto the meaning of this film? Like it's, and then case in point, Ken, like you mentioning the fact that the photographer is watching everything on a projector.
Yeah, like, that's brilliant. There's things that I want to go and watch it again now, because there's even little things that now you're like, oh yeah. Oh, right.
Yeah. Well, and that's part of the reason that we can go on for days. Like the fish, for example.
Yeah.
Well, like that's one of the reasons we do this podcast, is because we want to give you reasons to watch a movie, or give you a reason to rewatch a movie that you've maybe seen already, because maybe our perspective shakes something loose, or maybe this our discussion helps you have a discussion with somebody else. And that, because like we I don't want to run a podcast where we just bring on movies and tell you why you should avoid them. No, we chose Shudder because like every time I looked at their curated list and I was like, somebody has been doing their homework. This is a good little, you know, this is such an interesting, fun little movie. And like, this is a, like this.
Love
is,
me a video essay.
Yeah. And this is such a good, if you have been reticent about anime, because you think it's just like, you think it's like a weird medium, or it's all Voltron, or it's all Sailor Moon. This is such
all great
work in and of themselves for their own reasons, by the way, like not to knock them.
For sure. But tonally, if that's not people's cup of tea, I think, you know, like we were talking about even before, the idea that bringing up David Lynch, bring up Tarantino, bring up a lot of filmmakers. I mean, even filmmakers from other countries, Kurosawa, there's so many that I think if people are into those kinds of stories and filmmakers, I think they'd be pleasantly surprised with a film like this and the fact that there is a lot more anime out there that will make you think and feel in spaces like this. And
Graveyard of the Fireflies.
Yes.
Well, you want to wreck your weekend? Put out an animated movie, man.
Do you want to question your existence? Watch Serial Experiments Lane.
Yeah.
Like,
I was also going to tell you guys, because both of you mentioned Cowboy Bebop. I don't know if you saw the show that they made right after that called Samurai Champloo.
No.
Which is a must watch. It's another beautiful mashup of genres and styles. And it's, I remember correctly, it was only one season, similar to Bebop. It's an experience. It's beautiful, and
and that's kind of what Housing Complex C is. Anime is kind of like, it tends to avoid the multi-season trope. A lot of times, it can exist as just a single season. You know, like anywhere from like, also like you look, for example, as a random example, but like Tenchi Muyo, like if you watch like the different seasons, none of them are anywhere related story wise, but like they have all the same characters and the same general themes. But like one is Tenchi Muyo, one is Tenchi Universe, the other is it's just all over the place, and it all is based on who is currently working on it, kind of like a manga. It's made by like one or two people, whereas like, you know, these animes, sure, more people are involved, but the story is always very, very secluded, I suppose, if that makes sense.
I would say, so go with me here for a second. I think there's a lot of similarities between what comes out of the BBC and then what comes out of small anime like this, because like BBC tends to be with government money. It tends to be, you know, much lower production stuff, but it also means that you you only get six episodes or something like that. But as a result, they tend to be much more hands-off, so you can get much more interesting personal stories. And I think you kind of get that with the anime world. Like same thing. Well,
it's funny, because I think normally I'm fascinated hearing you guys say this, because I'm like, most shows I think are the opposite, where a lot of series are 24 episodes or they actually go quite in the other end with a lot of anime, where they, and usually the reason shows only have a season or two is because they actually get canceled, all anime for the most part is, you know, by and large, because it's from a manga essentially that was popular enough to greenlight the anime. But a lot of the time it's, you know, the productions are really intense. And sometimes it's a matter of like, it's the same thing as here with, you know, film and stuff. It's like, or shows, if a show comes out and it doesn't make enough to justify making more, even if it's a great thing and people love it, like they look at the dollar signs a lot of the time. And, you know, it's fascinating. I mean, like a show, like the studio that's doing Chainsaw Man, MAPPA, the show that they had previously been, I mean, they're working on a bunch of things, but the previous big show that they had been doing, that they're still doing, Jujutsu Kaisen, that first season had two cores. It was a 24 episode first season, And they put in so much effort into making that thing beautiful. It took so much time. And Chainsaw Man, they're only doing 12 episodes and they're even like doubling down on the quality. So you can tell that they were probably looking at it going, well, we could spend the next couple of years doing 24 episodes, or we could spend the next couple of years really focusing on 12. And with this project, hopefully, theoretically, because it's as popular, it can keep going. We don't know. But a lot of the time, I mean, I've been a part of plenty of shows that have a first season, are still going in manga form and are done after the first season because you're like, well, I guess that was the production, you know, like. And shows continue to go that like the first show I ever did, Welcome to Demon School. I like here in the West, it's amazing. It's a great show. It's like, I always say it's like Harry Potter meets the Breakfast Club.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it's super fun and wholesome and silly and weird. And it's a great entry anime for people with like families and friends and something they want like that's like soft and silly. Very different from Chainsaw Man, but
oh yeah, but I've watched a few clips from Chainsaw Man, and it's very intense.
You guys are gonna dig it. I think it's up your alley. From all the stuff we've been talking about, I think it's very much your cup of tea.
Do you have a dream English dub that you want to do?
Chainsaw Man was it?
Really?
I have the whole manga set here. Like, I've been a fan of this thing years before it was. I mean,
oh man, what was that feeling like when someone told you you'd be doing the English dub for Chainsaw Man?
Yeah, no, this is literally my dream role. Like, you know, it's that, and you know, as an actor, it's that thing like you don't allow yourself to have those because, you know, it's just not logical. But I read Chainsaw Man when it was, you know, going out, when that first whole run of the first 11 volumes was still finishing up, and just became completely obsessed with it because I really think it's that good, it's that special. And it blew my mind. And when they announced that they were going to adapt it, I was like, this is the only role I would ever want. That reading this, I was like, this is to get to play this kind of a character, to tell this kind of a story, to have these kinds of layers. Again, like you were talking about Psycho Goreman, like to have a title like Chainsaw Man and everybody be like, okay. And then you experience it and you're like, oh. Oh, you know, like it's this beautiful burrito of, you know, revealing itself. And I literally was like, I've never been so compelled by a thing. It was like the first time in years any piece of art had really like taken me outside of myself in a long time in that way, where I was like, what is this? And I remember, like, I would write it down to myself. I was obsessed with the idea of like, if these auditions ever come out, as far as for me to be able to see them, like, I have to bleed for this thing, you know? And I remember writing to my agents, like, I have the email from like 2.5 years ago, just being like, hey, you know, they haven't even started animating this yet, but they announced that they're going to be adapting it. I just want to keep an eye out for a year or two from now or whenever, if sides are going out, just this is the title, just so you know. And I would check in, like, when the first trailer dropped, like, 2 years ago, I was like, this is what it is, this is what it looks like, just keep an eye out. I don't know when it's going to go into production, like literally layers. Like, and then I was at Crunchyroll Expo, which Crunchyroll is a big streaming service for anime, and
I think I actually because I was watching a couple of interviews or a couple of conventions that you went to that you did little Q&A's for. I even think I saw the one where they asked you what your dream one was. I think you said Chainsaw Man.
Yeah. So that was that was like 8 or 9 months ago. And that was a thing, like, and I never, you know, like you get asked those questions sometimes. And I've always been really sheepish about that, where I'm like, I don't want to say, cause like putting out publicly is like, I don't know. I don't want to, you know? And like my two friends who were next to me, who were also actors, like they were kind of like, well, you know, this person did that. And I was like, ah, screw it. I'd love to read for that. And like, just thinking like, yeah, there's a room for a few people. No one will know, but so surreal. And yeah. And then I was at this convention, Crunchyroll Expo. I was just like doing guest stuff there, and they had a panel for Chainsaw Man with the creators from Japan who were working on the anime. So they were there like just kind of talking about it, and this was in August. So I like literally like put a sign on my table, like, be back in like an hour or something. I told the people, like, Brené, I was like, I'm going to this panel. Like, I have to go watch this. I'm sorry. Like, and I went, and obviously they were fine with it. I went and sat in the audience. I was like a couple seats back, you know, they replayed the trailer again. They were just talking about how serious they were taking the production and all this stuff. And I was just sitting there with goosebumps being like, yes, yes. You know, they're really treating this with the utmost of care that it deserves. Not even thinking like I'd actually get the chance, but just being like, I can't wait to experience this. And that day the auditions went out and like everybody, you know, who has an agent or otherwise that was, could receive these auditions got them. And I just remember like my heart, I was like, oh my God, this is really happening now.
Yeah, you get to take your shot.
Yeah. And I was genuinely, totally like, my heart was full just doing the audition. I was like, I got to play the, you know, my dream role even for a few minutes. And I want to say it was like a month later that I got the call and my heart was like, this is insane. It's still the most, this whole experience has been beyond insane.
Well, I think it's one of those things where you get that phone call and you want to be like, who is this?
Frank, well, are you being an
asshole right now?
The beautiful thing about it, what made it like instantly, it was so funny because like basically the person who called me was the guy who is voice directing it, who's a buddy of mine. His name is Mike McFarland, and he previously, he's voice directed a bunch of really wonderful stuff, but previously he voice directed all of Attack on Titan. So,
phenomenal
voice director. He really knows, one, he works with, you know, he knows how to work on an incredibly massive epic thing, and he knows how to get really great grounded performances, and he really just cares. And he sends me a text message and he's like, hey buddy, do you have a minute to talk? And you know, so I just text him back, you know, of course, yeah, sure, dude, what's up? And he instantly calls me and I'm going, well, that's, something must be going on.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. And so he calls me and he's like, hey man, he's just being like really sheepish going, yeah, you know, just wanted to let you know, I just got back from doing this thing over the weekend and blah, blah, blah. And so, yeah, it turns out I'm going to be directing Chainsaw Man. And I'm going, dude, that's incredible. Oh my God. I can't, like, this is so cool. Not processing. Like, why would he be telling me this? You know, like there's no reason. That's an NDA right there that he shouldn't be breaking. Why should he be telling me that? And then the gears are slowly starting to turn. Like, wait a minute. Am I a part of this? Am I going to be a part of this? And I'm thinking still like some small thing, like you're going to get to be a devil that he eviscerates or whatever. And he's like, yeah. So, you know, I was going through all these auditions and, you know, all this stuff and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I just wanted to call you and let you know. And like, my chest is getting tighter and tighter and tighter. And he's like, I just wanted to let you know, you're going to be Denji. You're going to be our Chainsaw Man. And it was like, you know, in war movies when like Saving Private Ryan, like the grenade goes off and like there's just the piercing like sound and everything's like like, yeah, that's what it felt like. And like I could hear him talking like and then we're gonna work on like and then it cleared up and like suddenly I heard him again. But it was just the most wild thing. Yeah.
Oh my God. I'm like, I could not possibly be like happier for you. Just like, just thank as your friend that we've like, that I've had the we've privilege known each other to for work years with.
Now, man.
Yeah. Like it's been so wonderful. Just like watching your,
thank you,
your career flourish. And it's been so nice, A, just to have you on this podcast with us, just talking shop.
Thank you so much. Oh my God. Thank you for, first off, I have to say, like, you guys, this podcast is amazing. You guys are amazing together. Kenneth, aww, you're a rock star. Like, oh, David, nice. I already knew you were incredible, but this is like the way that you guys run it, the insight you have, the passion you have, the understanding you have of film and everything. This is amazing.
Oh, God. Well, so glad that we had you on. I will be sure to have you on for more stuff in the future.
Oh, my God, I would
Shudder,
love it.
Yeah, I mean, take a look at Shudder. If there's anything in particular that you want to talk about, just hit us up and we'll fit it into the schedule because it's our show and we'll do what we want.
Amazing. Amazing. I would absolutely love that. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Of course. Ryan, where can the people find you on the socials and such if they want to hit you up and tell you how much they love your work?
or just tell me that it's poop.
Well, that too.
Tell me it's poop.
It's all projection.
It's all projection. Yeah. Exactly. you can find me on Twitter at Ryan Colt Levy, just my full name, or Ryan Colt on Instagram. And I think I'm on TikTok also as Ryan Colt Levy. I don't really use it too much, but like I throw up announcements and things there. I don't know how to TikTok. I'm sorry.
I watch the TikTok through Facebook like regular adults.
Yeah. I'm like, it gives me cat videos and cooking videos and the rest. I just like post, you know, the clip of whatever show I'm working on, but I don't know how to use it very well. But yeah, I try and keep it simple. I basically type in my name in full and you should be able to find me. So, and thank you if you do.
David, where can the people find you on the socials?
Oh, well, you can find me at _DW Marlowe, you know, where I get to my regular, get up to my regular musings and woodworking projects and the occasional fun stuff with my dog and my wife. And then, of course, I run our Instagram page for @Shudder_show, where we make all of our regular announcements. And I have been trying to get a lot better at just posting the funny horror videos and memes and the things that just make you smile in this craziness that is life. Ken, what about you, good sir? Where can the good people find you?
You can find me on Instagram and Twitter @KenStachnik, KenStachnik. And you can find us on Twitter with Shudder Show @Shudder Show. You can email us, shuddershow@gmail.com. And other than that, we will be back in less than a week with a interview talking about the movie May with Jill Six from the director of The Stylist. And yeah, I guess that makes it for our episode, which means we get to the very part of the end of the show where I say the most important thing at all, which is go fuck yourselves.
Love you.
Love you guys. Bye-bye.
Bye.